Ladies and gentlemen, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. This morning I'm going to speak about four things, really. I'm going to talk about the ICT revolution that we are caught up in at the moment and have been for the past few years. I'm going to talk to you as well about the Bournemouth experience, particularly of e-books. We started off using e-books very early on through the eBury contract that was negotiated by the SCPC. We also have taken the strategy of integrating as far as possible e-books into the virtual learning environment. So that's a little bit about our experience, and then I'm going to at least pose some questions as to where we might be going in the future. Now, who recognises the gentleman on the left with a feather in his cap? Any ideas? No? Well, this is Johann Fust, who was a partner of Gutenberg. He went off to Paris with some sacks full of Gutenberg Bibles to sell in Paris. And he was run out of town. And he was run out of town because no one could believe that these things could be produced without the aid of the devil. So they thought that he was in league with the devil in order to be able to produce such marvels. And of course he later became conflated with Johann Faust, who did form a pact with the devil. Now, the books were marvellous. People could not believe that such perfection could be attained. They also enabled a great speed of communication. When Luther nailed his theses to the door in Wittenberg, they were round Germany, printed, translated, within a few weeks. They were around Europe in a couple of months. And that was a huge development in terms of speed of communication, and also in terms of the wonder of the content that is produced. And that has resonances for us today, I'm sure, in how we view electronic content. Okay, and what about the other chap on the right? Anyone recognize him? No? Sorry? This is Oldenburg.
Oh, yes.
And of course he was the chap who at the Royal Society started off the Philosophical Transactions, one of the first scientific journals. And that did two things, of course. It both validated what the content that was received and published, but it also put a stamp of ownership on the content, for the first person to publish obviously had ownership. And of course from that has grown the whole of our scholarly research process throughout the centuries. Now, why am I talking to you about these chaps? Well, they are revolutionaries. They were revolutionaries. They were in at the start of the last ICT revolution, printing. They could not have foreseen what we know today in terms of the mature printing technology. They could not have foreseen the effects, social, political, economic, that printing technology would have. And we are in precisely the same position in terms of the latest electronic revolution. We cannot foresee how it's going to pan out. Right. I'd like you all to empty your minds. Look at the picture. See pink clouds. I want you to close your eyes. Hold hands with the person next to you. Right. I want you to think the 1960s. I want you to think North America. I want you to think the open road. And I want you to think motorbikes. Okay, now hold that image in your mind, whatever it is. Now then, how many of you saw something like this? A smattering. Yes. Right. How many of you saw something like this? Anybody? No. What is he doing there, thinking? Where on earth is he going with this? Well, back in the 1960s, the American motorbike market was dominated by companies like Harley, big machines, luxury machines, very well engineered. Honda tried to break into this market, but of course they did not have the quality of engineering then that the Americans had, and they simply could not compete. There was also difficulty about getting sales outlets, because who wanted to put that alongside a Harley Davidson? Not many people. What happened was that the Japanese sales force, who had been sent over to the States, they brought some of these little Honda 50s with them. And at the weekends, they would go dirt track riding on these Honda 50s in California. Now, other people saw this and thought, what great fun this would be. And Honda started importing Honda 50s for that market, for that sort of leisure market. And what that did was to give Honda an in. It gave them a foothold in the marketplace. And from there, they forced most of the other US bike producers out of business. And we were left with Harley Davidson, for instance, at the top, at the luxury end. Okay. It's what is called a disruptive technology. Now, there's a chap called Christensen, who in The Innovator's Dilemma, draws the distinction between sustaining technologies and disruptive technologies. Now, sustaining technology is generally a well-established technology with very good companies which develop that technology, and which listen to their customer base and are very successful. But their markets can be distorted, their markets can be usurped by disruptive technologies. And these are characterized by Christensen as having different features which are attractive to a niche market, to very few potential customers. But they are cheaper, simpler, smaller, and easier to use. And that is exactly the case with the Hondas, which Christensen uses as an example. They also tend to underperform the existing product. So they're never going to be as good as the Harley Davidsons, for instance. But, and this is the key point, they are good enough for the consumers. So in many ways, the sustaining technologies have gone beyond their market, where they are too high quality for the market to sustain. And Honda latched onto this, and this was the marketing campaign that Honda ran. Again, you see that appealing to a niche, a particular community. Those of you from universities, campaign was designed by a marketing student in the States, who now presumably is a very rich man. There is a slightly different case, which is the case of Kodak. Now, Kodak's business model was to sell cheap analog cameras, to sell them very cheap, and to make their revenue from the consumables, from the film, from the chemistry to develop the film and the prints, and from the paper itself. They did invest a lot of money in the research into digital imaging, but there was huge company middle management resistance to changing, to moving away from analog, from their core business, to digital. They thought that the digital business would only be confined to the professional market. They missed the possibilities of ICT. everyone has a desktop, a broadband, and that enabled that mass digital market, which we now see where digital cameras are very, very popular. And of course, as well, a key to the digital camera is it puts the user in control. I don't know if any of you are old enough to remember Larry Hagman and the British Gas advert, J.R. Ewing. Don't just love to be in control. So, from that rather long and tortuous preamble, what are the lessons for today? Well, the main lesson, I think, is that we are in the grips of an ICT revolution. There will be disruptive technologies such as the digital camera, such as the Honda motorbike, but we don't know what they are yet. Thinking about sustaining technologies, there are dangers for us as a profession, and I use that term in the widest sense, in developing products and tools beyond what the user needs, beyond what is good enough, and beyond what is immediately available. And we see in universities the very heavy uptake of Google search or Wikipedia. They are there, they are good enough, and they are immediate. And of course, they also empower the user. The user is in control. Right, so this is Bournemouth's experience. I'm sure that this graph will be repeated in universities around the country. And you'll see that we have in the blue column our print issues, which have been declining obviously quite steadily over the years. The red column is the downloads from electronic journals, and that showing a healthy rise year on year. And I must say that we are not a research intensive university, so a lot of that, if not the majority of that usage of electronic journals is by students. And then we see a quite startling increase in the number of views of e-books over the years. And you can see down in 2004-05 when we first started, we used the SCPC contract with eGRE, and that was very heavily used by our students, partly because they could use it as a database and search very easily. Over the years, we put on more and more ebooks as they become available, and we are fighting that constant battle with the publishers in that we need to get hold of the recommended textbooks as well as the wider reading. Now, we've been expecting these figures to tail off for ebooks as they've been tailing off, plateauing for e-journal downloads. But one of the things we've done over the past year or so, year and a half, is to bring in a resource discovery engine supplied by EBSCO. And you can see that this has driven some quite remarkable increases in the numbers of e-journal articles downloaded, up by a third, and also in the number of e-book sections consulted, which is up by nearly a half. Now that, given that we were running at just under 1 million for e-journal articles and just under 2 million for e-book downloads, those are quite remarkable jumps. Not all down to probably the resource discovery engine, but also down to single sign-on and the fact that we integrate as far as possible into the VLE. Right, VLEs, I'm sure you all, or most of you, are familiar with the virtual learning environment, also confusingly called an LMS, Learning Management System. This is the key pervasive technology for students in universities, particularly undergraduates. They use it multiple times, many times a day. They will go into it as a matter of course throughout the day. And what it has in it is content, which can be timed, so it's only exposed to students when the lecturer wishes. It enables communication between lecturers and their students, between groups of students, and between whole classes as well. It's a vehicle for assessment, and sometimes for the submission of assignments and so forth. It will also contain syllabus information and administrative information as well, and is also hospitable to, or might contain, virtual classrooms. I don't know if any of you have come across the technology, the big blue button. No? Well, yes, well worth a look. They could do away with this sort of event. It could do away with this sort of event, for instance. But do go and have a look at that. If we think about the content that appears in the VLE, this is broadly falls into two categories. Two levels. First, there is the in-house content produced by the lecturers, where this can be course content, including lecture notes, lectures themselves, assessments and assignments. But then there is another level, which is external to the university. And here we see the university will be buying the recommended texts linked through reading lists, linking ebooks through reading lists. There will be digitized chapters, and many of us, I'm sure, make great use of the CLA's digitization license. So that is at the very base level of what is prescribed for the students to read. We are also all, I'm sure, experimenting with the unlovely term patron plans, or demand driven usage, demand-driven plans. What happens here, it's like the old on-approval service in the printed world. You deposit a sum of money with an ebook provider, and then you select a range of texts by particular authors or on particular topics, for instance. And those texts are bought by the library automatically when the usage by students reaches a certain level. So what you're doing there is actually transferring the decisions on purchase to the student. And in these days of the National Student Survey, that can be a very useful tool to have in our armory. So that is the second level, which is still tied quite closely into the syllabus, into the course materials. But then the other thing that we integrate into the VLE, on every page of Bournemouth's VLE, there is a library tab which takes students out to the discovery engine. And there they are, they have available to them through the VLE, apparently, without leaving the VLE at all, our bought electronic content, free electronic content, what is in our institutional repository. And interestingly, we've seen great usage of lecturers' research publications by their students simply because they are available through the resource discovery tool. And of course, we also get hold of what used to be called grey literature and media resources such as Box of Broadcasts. So it is all there for them. But we still talk in old money. We talk about serials or journals. And we talk about monographs or books. That's still still the way that we used to refer to hard copy. And we are still really in that straitjacket in terms of the content producers. We are here today talking about e-books. Well, why should we talk about e-books? What has what we buy got to do with a book? Now, this, it seems to me, is where the VLEs will come into their own as disruptive technologies. At the moment, we are in the world of blended learning, where some of the learning will be face-to-face, some of the learning will be virtual, it will be synchronous or asynchronous. But what has happened, particularly with the advent of the virtual classroom, such as Big Blue Button, is that we have potentially cut that link, that geographic, that spatial link between the student and the academic. And once that is fully realized, things will change markedly. We are already getting some core common content being produced. This might be produced commercially or for free, for instance, through MIT or the Open University. What I believe we shall see over the next few years is that publishers will not be publishing the equivalent of textbooks. They will be publishing the equivalent of modules for courses. Why should they not? And that changes the boundaries of in-house versus external production. And we can foresee a time when there's a large amount of common content which is delivered to students remotely from any university. That is anathema to many academics, but what it does do is to create a unique selling point for universities. So it will be the research and the reputation of staff that will attract students. And those staff, because the common core content will be delivered not by them, but virtually, they will be free to engage much more closely with the student. And I'm sure that any academics in the room will have their hackles raised by that. So, I'm going to leave you with questions rather than answers, I'm afraid. Are universities ready to change? And I mean universities in the widest sense, librarians, academics, managers and technicians, are we ready to embrace that sort of change and make half our real estate redundant? What is the role going to be of the commercial and private higher education providers? Are they going to take a lead in this? Are they going to usurp that common core because they can deliver it more efficiently than the traditional universities? What are the publishers? And there are publishers here today who might answer this question. Are they ready to be educators? Are they ready to cross that boundary? And what about students? Are they ready to embrace this sort of change? Well, I think they are, and I think that this is a trajectory which will be intensified by the advent of the higher fees. So let's try and get beyond the packaging, which is what seems to be driving us today. Are there any questions?
Yes, we have a few minutes of questions, so if anybody got anything to ask, we're going to have a panel at the end of the day. But David has been so efficient that you have a chance of questions. Any questions? I can't see it, but I know it's there. Could you give your name and affiliation, please?
Yes, United States. Stephanie Gross from Yeshiva University. I'm simply interested in... Stephanie Gross from Yeshiva University, New York. I'm just curious as far as what you would like we as academics to try to do now in order to put in place some standards, perhaps, and some thoughts about access and equity for licensing, for prices, and so forth? Should we be in the deal now and not be the bystanders?
Well, I'd certainly recommend you to get stuck in to announce yourselves as a player. A lot of the content initially may well be produced by individual universities, as we've seen with MIT and the Open University, and then made freely available. But the only way this is going to change is if people take a leap into the unknown. So I'd encourage you to make a start and talk with publishers about, as you say, the rights and licenses for materials.
Another
question.
Hi, I'm Nicola Hayden from the Royal Society of Chemistry. I'm interested to know if what your experiences have been dealing with ePub aggregators and with publishers directly to source your e-content?
Well, many and varied. I mean, we... we use a wide range of aggregators, and one of the criteria that we are starting to set is that the content of the aggregators must be searchable through the resource discovery engine, because as we've seen, that's what's driving usage. So if any aggregators or publishers' content is not available to be searched in that way, then we will tend not to buy it. There is a difficulty at the moment as well, because we can't be absolutely certain where we can get an ebook from. We might be able to get it in multiple places. It might be only with one aggregator or publisher. So that's been a bit of a hindrance for us. But we do, as I say, use multiple channels for purchasing ebooks.
Okay, we have one more question. It's Chris Batt down here.
Thanks for reminding me who I am, don't you?
I was searching, but I just remembered suddenly.
It's more of a reflection than anything. I mean, Clay Christensen's work is helpful to draw the attention to the fact that the disruptiveness is not about the technology, it's about the effect the technology has on organisations.
Yeah.
And one of the things he says at the beginning of his book is that it makes no difference whether you're the world's best organisation or worst, you're still going to get disrupted. So he looked at, so I think it was manufacturers of disk drives, and they were just completely wrong-footed by stuff coming up in another direction. And it seems to me some of the issues are going to be fairly fundamental. And questions about what do universities do, what institutions do is, you either do nothing and hope that the best pull the covers over your head, or try and look towards what the international futures world calls transformative innovation, which is thinking beyond that. So the kind of, you know, the Stanford computer degree that you can do now completely remotely is completely free. So it seems to me that one's got to go beyond just the disruption and try and work out what you can draw from distance and others about how you might react in a very complex situation.
Yeah. And yes, as in the case of Kodak, for instance, they did not see, and their business has shrunk to virtually nothing. And what I'm trying to do this morning is to raise that flag, as you picked up. But, you know, we're all in that position now, and the VLE, as I see, is a disruptive technology that will change everything for us.
Thank you. Maybe we haven't got any time for questions, but remember there's a panel at the end. So thank you very much.
Thank you.